This week on A Lively Experiment, college protests over the war in Gaza come to prominence this week, posing a dilemma for administrators. And a new configuration of the lanes on the Washington Bridge seem to be clearing the clogged traffic.
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
Joining us on the panel, political contributor Pablo Rodriguez, Sue Cianchi, National Committee Woman for the Rhode Island Republican Party, and Providence College political science professor Adam Myers. Welcome into Lively. I'm Jim Hummel. We appreciate you spending part of your weekend with us. It was probably inevitable that the protests and encampments at Ivy League schools that have led the national news this week would eventually reach Rhode Island. And early Wednesday, they did at Brown University, where the administration now has to decide whether to clear the tents from the green, a violation of university property. Policy. We are taping on a Friday morning. Adam, let me begin with you. I think the larger question here is, where does free speech, where does it cross the line into maybe not protected free speech?
That's right. And it's a very complicated situation that university administrators like President Paxton find themselves in right now, because as you just said, students have First Amendment rights. And universities are supposed to be places of free expression and free thought, and they should facilitate the free speech rights of their students. But it is important to bear in mind these students are a relatively small percentage of Brown students, the ones who are protesting, right? The students who are not protesting and who may not agree with the ones who are, they have rights too, right? They have a right to be safe. They have a right to not be harassed. They have a right to use the facilities that their tuition dollars are paying for. And so how do you balance the rights of the protesters against the rights of everyone else? It's a challenging question.
Yeah, I think Americans on a whole believe in free expression. They believe in the First Amendment. They believe in the right to protest. But when does that right to protest turn into intimidation? So the students that feel that they're being intimidated. And the other thing is, this is such an organized protest. Like, are these really college students? You know, you go back to what happened with the Chaz environment in Seattle. It was a mess. It was not organized. You look at some of these protests from Columbia to Brown with the same types of tents all over the place. Who's funding these
They're pretty
students?
Nice tents.
They're pretty nice tents and expensive. You know, I went to college and I didn't have any money to do any of this. So who is really protesting? And are they against Western civilization? Are they against, is it a pro-terrorist group? So yeah, the colleges have a big mess on their hands.
Listen, there's no doubt that there are elements coming into these protests that are anti-Semitic, that have other ideas in mind. But on the whole, the majority of the students are basically protesting against a war in Gaza, where they are seeing thousands of innocent people getting killed. And these kinds of movements, just like anti-apartheid, just like the against the Vietnam War, always begin in colleges. I think it's a problem for a university whenever you try to stop the exercise of free speech, even free speech that it is, objectionable. And in any protest, some people are going to feel intimidated. So that cannot be the measure of what is an appropriate protest and what is an inappropriate protest. In my university, the one that I have in my imagination, I would just bring pizza to the protesters and have police presence just to protect and prevent any kind of interaction. But I just can't see how setting up a couple of tents in Columbia University was going to interrupt the educational process.
But it's not just that. What would you do at Cianchi U?
Yeah, but this is the problem. When you have conservative speakers that are not allowed to go to universities to present their ideas. I mean, look what happened to Riley Gaines out at the University of San Francisco. They protested so much that she couldn't even talk. Even Charlie Kirk, you may or may not agree with his ideas, but you're not allowing these conservatives to come to universities and present their ideas. And isn't that what a university is all about? You should be presenting both sides. And you talk about, you know, what's happening in Gaza. Some of these students are so ill-informed and ignorant about the issues. Let's have a real debate on college campuses, and both sides are presented, you know, their ideas. But that's not what's happening.
Well, that started with Ray Kelly at Brown all those years ago, the police commissioner, and they shouted him down. Adam, what you said was interesting to me because I've watched a lot of the national coverage, particularly at Columbia. Is it coincidental? Are these people really worried about COVID that they're totally covered in masks and they're wearing sunglasses? Is that not skeptical me? To obscure facial recognition?
Oh, I think it almost certainly is. I can't imagine that it's primarily about COVID. Again, I just want to emphasize something I said earlier. The national media is paying a great deal of attention to these protests, and perhaps they should, right? But as best as I can tell, it's a small percentage of students that are engaged in these protests on these campuses. And these campuses are a relatively small share of the American higher ed scene, more broadly speaking. I think it's an open question the extent to which this will continue to be a national issue, right, the extent to which it will affect the presidential election, and so on and so forth. All of the polling data that we have thus far suggests that, you know, the Middle East issue is not at the top of the minds of most voters. It's not one of the most important problems that people mention when they're asked, you know, what do you think the most important problem is facing this country right now?
Well, and graduation's in a month.
Yeah.
They're not going to be there in July, and August. So does it just fade out? Like, remember Occupy Providence all those years ago in Kennedy Plaza? It just kind of, it got cold and everybody went home.
That's why I would bring pizza. Because what would happen when you repress speech, what you create is more animosity. You create more ability for people to then just say, we are going to protest in solidarity. And this is going to become a worldwide movement. This is already becoming a worldwide movement.
But then you have the issue at Columbia. These kids who started in the pandemic and now this is their senior year, they're virtual the rest of the semester. Now it's only a month. And at the University of Southern California, they canceled the big graduation. Can you imagine being a parent out there?
No, I would be furious. Yeah. You know, the one thing that you're celebrating, your students' accomplishments, and that's being taken away from you. It's not right. I think if I was a parent at Columbia and I was paying that exorbitant tuition that they're charging, I would want a refund because we found that these virtual classes, you're not getting the same interaction. You're not getting that social interaction with your professor, with your fellow students. You're not in the same room. It's just not the same quality of education that you're getting.
All right, we shall see. Folks, we have been talking an awful lot since December about the Washington Bridge, and that actually may be coming to an end. I flew in this morning with the three lanes. The DOT has reconfigured the lanes going east and west to three lanes. We were, Pablo, we'll start with you. We were a little skeptical maybe that's going to result in some more accidents. By all accounts, and people I talked to in the East Bay, it's gotten a lot better. The DOT got it right on this one.
Well, of course, you have more lanes, you're going to have better traffic. The problem is that summer is not here yet. And once people start going to the Cape, you're going to know if this is going to really, really work or if accidents are going to increase. I think the traffic situation is something that just brought the attention to everybody. But what we should be paying attention to is, why are we here? You know, bridges don't heal themselves. And this idea that an examination of the bridge showed it to be deficient, you know, 10 years ago and all of a sudden got better, that's something that really needs to be in front and center as opposed to, you know, it took me another 20 minutes to get to work.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think the governor must be breathing a huge sigh of relief right now. You know, this has been an albatross around his neck, and chances are it's going to continue to be an albatross's neck, but perhaps a smaller albatross. And the fact that the westbound portion of the bridge isn't going to be completed until the summer of 2026 means that we're going to be hearing about this for years to come, and we're going to be talking about this during the gubernatorial campaign season a few years from now. My sense is that most people, it's kind of baked in at this point. Most people have factored the situation on 195 into their routine right now. It's become a part of their daily lives. And, you know, by the time the gubernatorial race rolls around, it's not going to be the central issue. But there could be a whole lot of hiccups that occur along the way that change that, you know, prognosis.
Yeah, I think people have altered their behavior. I mean, they've changed the way that they've gotten back and forth to work. And I think Dr. Pedro is right. Dr. Pablo is right.
We were talking about Dr. Pedro before the show. It's an inside joke. Go ahead.
I think that he's right. You know, summer is coming. And when people start going to the Cape, it's going to increase the traffic. And then will there be concerns about the other span? You know, how safe is that? Because you are increasing the weight. You're increasing the traffic on that. I'm still waiting for the day of reckoning.
And you're going to trust the inspections?
Yes. No, you're not. And you're right. And I think, you know, Rhode Islanders get this attitude, oh, well, you know, oh, well, it's Rhode Island. It doesn't matter. This is typical. I think people need to expect more when you take on the role of leadership in the state. Hold people accountable. Why do we not hold them accountable for these mistakes? We just allow them to collect their pension and move to Florida, and everything is just copacetic and fine.
And you know who's been the savior in Rhode Island ever since I've been a reporter? It's the federal government. They prosecuted Cianci. They prosecuted a lot of others. And I wonder, look, the feds aren't letting this go.
No.
Just because the traffic is eased a little bit, a lot of federal money went into that bridge. Now, last week we talked a lot about Patrick Anderson's story in the Journal about there's political fallout about the DOT said they didn't really know about this. There were warning signals. But I wonder what the feds are, and the feds take their time, what they're doing now. And I think that's the investigation I think we should be looking at.
Absolutely. And they are the ones that are really most concerned about inspection of bridges that somehow heal themselves. It's just a real problem when the federal government is investing millions of dollars. Because remember, this bridge was being refurbished when we discovered that it was, you know, worthless. So this is a felony. This is going to be people are going to go to jail as a result of this situation.
You feel badly for the businesses on each side. And the governor, it's funny, he put in a supplemental budget request. And people said, oh, where did he come up with that money? Well, he took it from that project in East Providence that still has not gotten, you know, fully underway. And you just wonder, $1.3 million, is that going to come anywhere close to helping the businesses?
It's a drop in the bucket, you know, and so I think the answer to that is no. But symbolically, you know, it looks good. It suggests that he's at least aware that he's trying. And so from a political perspective, it might be a little beneficial. But I don't think it's going to paper over the economic losses that those businesses have suffered.
Yeah, I think for advertising, as we've seen before, we're cooler and warmer. Every advertising campaign that we have had in the state of Rhode Island has turned into a colossal joke. So is this going to be another colossal joke and another albatross around Governor McKee's neck? You know, maybe it will not. In 2 years, people may forget. They may have amnesia about this whole bridge process. But I don't think so, because that bridge is not going to be done by 2026.
Yeah, quick poll. Who thinks the bridge is going to be done by the end of 2026? Anybody? 2027?
All right, 2027. They're very optimistic.
No. You've been living in Rhode Island way
since 2016. I've tried not to be in the business of predicting.
Yeah, that's not a good thing to do. Well, that is a good segue into there is legislation before the General Assembly about the way we vote. You know, it's changed a lot since the pandemic. Early voting, mail ballot voting. Now, Sue, I'll start with you. This is, in my mind, a minor bill. In Rhode Island, if you're unaffiliated and you want to vote in a primary, you go in and you say, I want a Democrat or Republican ballot. And if you don't disaffiliate, then all of a sudden, surprise, that's who you are for the next primary. So this would remain unaffiliated. I think the larger issue is about how the national and local parties are going to approach the election this fall, because mail ballots are here to stay.
Right. Interesting enough, statistically, about 10% of people vote by mail. That changed during the pandemic because people were afraid to go to the polls. So you had about 33% of people in 2020 that voted by mail. But in 2022, that went back down to the 10 to 11%. Interesting enough, most people statistically still vote in person on election day. That is where you're going to get the bulk of your voters. The early voting, of course, has probably taken away from some of those people that voted by mail because you've given them the opportunity. Personally, I think the early voting is too long. I think it's too expensive for a lot of these local cities and towns. And the early voting that we have in place now, it's Monday through Friday, in some jurisdictions, 8 to 4. Who is that helping? I would like to see, if you're going to do early voting, do it Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 5 days before the election, and keep it open on the weekend so you really are making it easier for people to vote and giving them the opportunity. You have to show your ID. You're going in. It's a safe, effective way to vote. But and I'd also like to get rid of third-party ballot harvesting. It's absolutely unnecessary, and it really could affect how somebody votes. You've heard these ballot harvesters go in and say, I'm representing John Jones. We'll take your ballot for you. Well, that person that's voting, it's not private. It's you have somebody literally leaning over your shoulder grabbing your ballot for you. It's undue pressure on somebody to vote for that specific candidate. You can have a family member, a caregiver. We have no objection to that. But third-party ballot harvesting should stop. We should skinny down how long we do early voting. It's expensive. And if you look at the past, how people have voted, maybe the first day you'll get a uptick, and then you don't see a lot of early voting until the end. So let's be practical
about it. Yeah, I think the majority of them do it right before, maybe in the 3 or 4 days before the election. It's 20 days now. There have been some discussions, maybe 10, or as Sue said, the weekend. What do you think about that on early voting?
Listen, I think the cat's out of the bag on early voting, right? The nationwide trend is to expand voting options for people. And Rhode Island has historically been behind the times in terms of the giving people different options to vote.
Really? Rhode Island's been behind the times?
Shocking.
That's a shocker.
Look, in some states, it's all vote by mail, right?
Oregon.
Oregon, all the West Coast states, Colorado, Utah, and so on and so forth. In all those states, the state government mails a ballot to every single registered voter. Most of those states have some of the highest turnout rates in the country. Now, I take Sue's point. I mean, I think it's important to state that, voter fraud, ballot harvesting, very rare, including for a vote by mail. But it does happen. There was that notorious case in 2018 out of North Carolina that you might recall, that ballot harvesting scandal.
With the whole congressional district that was getting redone.
Right, yeah. That's right. And so I think laws to tighten that up so as to prevent those kinds of things are important. But I think, Rhode Island policymakers should accept that people want more options to vote. On the other hand, what Sue said is true. Voting by mail in Rhode Island went up, obviously, during the pandemic. But in 2022, after we passed the Let RI Vote Act, it went down. And so a lot of people still appreciate and prefer to vote in polling places on election day, and we should certainly facilitate that as well.
I think we should just expand as much as we can. We have a government now that is elected not even by half of the people because we have such poor participation. In other countries, like Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, 90, 92% of people vote, and it's much, much harder. So we have to figure out a way of increasing citizen participation because the government that we have is not elected by the majority. It's elected by a minority. And in terms of voting by mail and getting assistance from somebody, some people need assistance. Some people can't read well. Some people can't read at all. And we have to understand that we cannot have policy by exception. In any kind of government interaction, you're going to have some degree of fraud. It doesn't matter. You're not going to, outlaw everything simply because there's going to be some degree of fraud. We have to look at the big picture, and it's increasing citizen participation is good for a democracy.
Just quick response to that.
Yeah, I think you don't accept fraud. You try to put parameters in place. You put guardrails so that these things don't happen. I mean, with our mail ballots, you can accept an X. Previously, it had to be two witnesses or a notary, or there's got to be some kind of identification on the mail ballot to say that this is the person who it is. I've sat through the signature verification. It's a joke. I mean, it is literally a joke because they accept everybody. They accept almost every signature. You don't want to disenfranchise somebody that is voting, but there's got to be some kind of safeguard there that the person voting is who the person says it. And why do we have voter ID here in Rhode Island? Because of what happened with Anastasia Williams when she went to vote. She was a big proponent of making sure that the person who is voting is who they say they are. So I'm a big proponent of, you need ID for everything. Make sure that we have some type of identification and you want to prevent it. Are there things that go wrong in every election? Sure, there are anomalies that happen. Does it change the outcome of an election in a significant way?
But you want to have confidence.
But you want to have confidence. You want to make sure that you have confidence.
All right. The last topic I want to get to before we do outrageous and or kudos is abortion is on the mind of the Supreme Court this week. Pablo, you had brought this case to my attention in Idaho that I didn't even know that law existed. So I think the larger discussion is, how is that going to fit into the election? We know in 2022 it was a big deal. A lot of people concerned about the economy and immigration. So, I mean, I think people say, oh, abortion is going to be the overriding. There are a lot of people who that doesn't affect, that they don't care. But the Supreme Court is very interested right now.
I think 2022 election was a clear showing that reproductive rights are going to be in the ballot. As a matter of fact, I think that the ballot is going to be, you know, border security versus reproductive rights. I think the economy is going to move away from people's, you know, radar. The fact that as a physician, if I was in Idaho, I have to sit next to a patient that is bleeding, waiting for that patient to get close to death so I can do the right thing for that patient. That's what this law, this overturning of Roe versus Wade has created. Everybody keeps talking about abortion. Roe versus Wade not only has impacted abortion, it has impacted medical care. And this is emergency care. People showing up to the emergency room, women that are bleeding and dying in the parking lot because they are not treated as a result of this law. And in the states where the ban has gone into effect after the decision, we had 64,000, there's an estimate that 64,000 rape victims became pregnant and were not able to have an abortion. So this is, and forget about the IVF situation that happened, you know.
In Alabama.
In Alabama. Yeah. So if I have a problem with my heart, I don't go to a plumber. If I have a problem in my heart, I go to a cardiologist. And I think that this is the problem here. Legislators are trying to practice medicine, and they don't know what they're doing.
You know, Roe v. Wade said there's no constitutional right to an abortion. So when there's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government is in control, it goes back to the states. It's a dead issue here in Rhode Island.
But it'll be decided. You look now, though. Kansas already decided. Florida's going to be on the ballot. Arizona. I don't know about Idaho, but that is going to be an issue. And I wonder, from a Republican Party perspective, whether there's a concern that that's going to drive voters conservative. Well, in conservative states, traditionally, you're going to get more voters coming out for that issue that could put that state in play. Is that a concern?
It certainly was a concern in 2022. I mean, I think some of the candidates didn't address it properly. They didn't answer the question. You know, I look at issues. We have an open border. It's a huge issue. I look at things that affect you on a day-to-day basis. You look at the number of abortions that we've had in Rhode Island. In 2020, we had 5,000. In 2022, we had 1,500. With the availability of contraceptions out there, contraceptive devices, take some personal responsibility and make sure that you take take care of yourself. Now, there are exceptions for rape and incest. It's such a small percentage. You know, I don't think there's a physician out there that is going to allow a woman to die if she's bleeding out. That's medical malpractice for me.
That's exactly right.
That is medical malpractice.
But that's exactly what's happening now.
But it shouldn't be happening.
Okay,
good. And then you're not a good physician if you are allowing a woman to die. I mean, and I don't think
there's any... You're going to go to jail if somebody sues you?
Who is going to put a physician in jail who actually saves a woman's life?
Doctors are leaving Idaho as a result. Medicine, the difference between being alive and being dead during a complication of pregnancy can take seconds, minutes, hours. You don't know. There's not a switch that tells me, oh, this woman is about to die, so now I can intervene. This is the problem. You are violating the law if you intervene when you think it's medically appropriate and the lawyers decide that you're not.
You want to jump in here?
Yeah, well,
you're in the crossfire here.
I am not.
We are dispensing with outrages because I want to finish this discussion. Go ahead.
I am not going to weigh in on
I have a great outrage, so come on.
All right, so quickly, and then we'll get to the outrage.
So I won't weigh in on the substantive issue of abortion. My two fellow colleagues here have done an excellent job in their debate, and I'll just let them have it. But I will say, in terms of the issue of abortion and the way it's played out within American democracy, as a political scientist who studies comparative state politics, what's been really fascinating for me to watch is the way abortion rights advocates across the country have used the ballot initiative option, right, which exists in lots of states, the ability of voters to bypass politicians and put policy issues directly on the ballot for people to vote on. They have used that initiative option to legalize abortion in red states, right? Like Ohio, almost certainly like Arizona come November, and Florida as well. And this in my view, is democracy in action. And it does raise the question of why we don't have the ballot initiative here in Rhode Island. I think there are problems with it. The ballot initiative is a tool that needs to be exercised sparingly. It needs to be restricted. But certainly when a political system is all jammed up and when the people's will isn't being followed because the elected officials don't want to follow it, it's a way for the people's voice to be heard.
And isn't that, it goes back to states' rights then?
Yeah,
they're
going
to decide.
Yeah, it goes back to states' rights. Wouldn't it be wonderful in Rhode Island if we actually had ballot initiatives?
I saw you smiling over there.
Line item veto, inspector general.
It wouldn't be for abortion rights because two-thirds of Americans believe that abortion should be legal. So the overwhelming majority.
But there should be restrictions. They believe in it,
there
and there should be restrictions.
There are restrictions already.
The point you made, though, is that there are, you said it's malpractice, 30 seconds left, that in Idaho they're leaving because they don't want to have to make that decision because they're worried about being prosecuted,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. One out of every five doctors is leaving.
Right, so it's courts and prosecutors that are getting involved.
Absolutely.
And in Texas, too. All right. I'm sorry we didn't get to your outrage. You can tell me after. Quickly, what's your outrage?
What the president has done with Title IX and changing it. You're taking away women's rights, you're taking away due process, you're taking away free expression. I think it is absolutely outrageous, the changes to Title IX.
All right, fellas, I'm sorry. You can tell me off camera. Folks, that is all the time. Thank you for joining us for this lively. Sue and Adam and Pablo, thank you. Come back and join us next week. We are in the heart of the legislative session. On the backstretch to the end of the session, we'll be talking about much more about that next week. Come back as a lively experiment continues. We hope you have a great weekend.
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.